Hey, y'all. This is Volts for March 15th, 2024. Getting ready for IRA 2. I'm your host, David Roberts. In 2021, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, or OSTP, created a new division devoted to the clean energy transition. The number two guy in that division, later number one, when founding leader Sally Benson returned to MIT, was Costas Samaras, a longtime climate policy researcher out of Carnegie Mellon University and a beloved staple of energy Twitter. While he was in the Biden administration, Samaras worked on a whole variety of projects, exploring and roadmapping the technologies needed to hit U.S. climate targets, both near and long term. He worked on Biden's Net Zero Game Changers initiative and report, as well as reports and roundtables on AI, crypto, fusion, transformers, and many other nagging clean tech questions. He had a front row seat to the scale and transformative potential of the Democrats' legislative achievements. But he also saw what remains to be done. He's back at Carnegie Mellon now, running the university-wide Clean Energy Institute there, and he's been thinking about what the next IRA might look like. So I thought I'd call him up to chat about it. What he saw in the belly of the beast, what he has learned about moving technologies to scale, and what he would like to see in the next round of U.S. climate policy. All right, then, with no further ado, Costas Samaras, welcome to Volts. Thank you for coming.
Such a pleasure to be with you, David.
Costas, you and I have been going back and forth in various ways for many years now in the greenosphere. And I noticed a couple of years ago, you sort of vanished from the socials, as they say. And I sort of had heard vaguely that you went into the administration. But, you know, just in the last couple of days, emailing you about what you've been doing, it's sort of like you've been a bit of a zealot in the administration in terms of climate stuff. You've seen a lot of corners, a lot of areas, studied a lot of different subjects up there. So the first thing I guess I'd just like to hear from you is, like, you know, what you've been doing. What did you do in the administration, and what did you see?
Well, in the summer of 2021, I got extremely lucky to join the Biden-Harris administration as the Principal Assistant Director for Energy and Chief Advisor for Energy Policy in one of the offices in the White House. This is the Office of Science and Technology Policy, or OSTP. And so I did that role for about a year and a half, and then I was promoted to the Chief Advisor for the Clean Energy Transition in that office. So from summer of 2021 till the beginning of 2024, I was inside of the White House working with an amazing group of colleagues on what I hope what we will discuss today, the most ambitious climate policy in history, David.
So you really saw it close up, because the, you know, for reasons Volts listeners are very familiar with at this point, this vehicle had to go through reconciliation, which meant that it couldn't really involve a lot of rule or regulatory changes or a lot of standards. So it was mostly just tech innovation policy, basically. Like, that's kind of what ended up surviving the gauntlet, and that's squarely where you were sitting. So I think people, you know, out in the world, the news about Biden's climate policy comes to them in sort of fragmented ways, and they hear a little bit here and a little bit there. I think it is your belief, which I share, that people don't necessarily appreciate the comprehensiveness and the thoughtfulness and just the scale of what was accomplished. So before we get into what's next, maybe just talk a little bit about that, sort of like from the insider's view, your impression of the, not just what came out, but sort of the approach to it.
Well, I want to give credit first to the colleagues in Congress who got this done, and really the rest of the folks in the White House who are a little bit more closer to the day-to-day legislation to get it over the finish line. But if you take a step back and you think about climate policy up until this point, which generously, I think we could categorize as three PDFs in a trench coat. and with no...
There's anything wrong with PDFs.
You know, PDFs, I love a PDF. And not to take anything away, but I think all of us who've been kind of scarred from Waxman Markey and all of the things that we tried to do before, and people have been working very, very hard for a very long time to get stuff done, and to come out on the other end with the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Inflation Reduction Act, and also the Chips and Science Act, with the slimmest of congressional majorities, is really a miracle. I think that we take that for granted, that what we have now versus what we had before. And I think also, I was looking through a bunch of your old posts, and I remember that you were hammering on about, hey, we should electrify the Postal Service vehicles, right?
And, yes.
I mean, so like all these things that you and me and everyone else had wanted to do for a long, long time. It was like, this is a good idea. We should do this. A lot of it's done, right? A lot of it actually got done. Post office vehicles, electric buses, transportation rail investments, passenger rail investments, public transit, like all kinds of things that, and we can go through them one by one, is just like, hey, we should do that. I get a lot of times folks on the internet, it's like, you know, when I was in the administration, it's like, you all should do that. And I was like, it's actually right there. It's some of that is done. But, you know, I want to make sure it's very clear that it's like, we got so much more to do. But we can sit back and look back and say, wow, did we just win for once?
I know. It is so hilarious watching the left try to process a win. It's just like they just don't know how. They literally don't know how. Like, and I mean that in a very concrete way, just the sort of mechanisms and the language and the behaviors that one would use upon succeeding are just like alien to the left. And so it's been like watching a child fumbling around with an unfamiliar toy or something.
Well, there's a danger of me just listing all the stuff, right? It's like, look at these list of bullet points, right? So now it's not three PDFs, it's 100 PDFs. But just like at the margin, everybody can see themselves in the wins that came out of these bills. I mean, even before, if you remember, we were spending $3 to $4 billion on clean energy R&D. Now, clean energy R&D got ramped up by a whole bunch, but just like one little program that I don't even know if anybody even knows that there's a $3 billion program to electrify ports in the country.
Yeah, I just saw that the other day.
It's like one little thing. It's like, oh, we did that? Yeah. I mean, people are going to be breathing much cleaner air. There's going to be fewer asthma attacks, fewer heart attacks, fewer people going to the hospital, fewer people dying from just one little thing in a giant bill.
And that is specifically, like, that's a great example because it's really good on decarbonization. And it's really good on economic and environmental justice. Like, it's a good thing to do for poor people, which tend to be the people living around those ports. So it's like it was a dual win on two of the things that the Democratic base most says they want.
And I will say, you know, on a day-to-day basis, from the president and vice president on down, it was very clear that we were all focused on improving people's lives and making sure that nobody's left behind, and to reinvest in communities that have been overburdened by pollution. And I think that you've been saying this for a while. It's like climate change and the clean energy transition also happens to clean the air.
Yeah.
Right? It's like a bonus.
And as I've said, it's a little weird that that's the also, since that's the majority of the effect on people's lives that people will be able to see and notice.
Yeah. I mean, and as the investments from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act start rolling out, people will start to feel that this is good. And I hope so, because we're going to need more, right? To get all the way to zero, we're going to need more.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a side question, but you raise it. So I wonder if you have any perspective on this. Like, one of the critiques I hear sometimes about all the things that were accomplished is, you know, there's a million things. Like, just the other day, I was like, oh, $7 billion for low-income solar. Like, that alone is mind-boggling. And like, here I am, a professional who covered the development and passage of these bills. And still, it's like almost on an almost daily basis. I'm like, oh, look, there's like more billions of dollars for more good stuff that I didn't even know about. But one of the critiques you hear is that all these good things are happening and there hasn't been a commensurate sort of communications effort. And consequently, no one knows about it. And the more worrying thing is that even as these things start happening and people feel them happening, people aren't going to make the connection to Biden and policy because there's no one in their face pointing out that connection. I don't know if you want to get into the whole communications thing, but do you have any thoughts on that?
You know, at the politics level, it really matters because people need to connect that there was advocates that made this happen. The community basically said climate is important. And then what the administration did is, okay, here's the biggest things we've ever done. And so on the politics, I think it is important that there's a connection and everybody needs to be doing a better job in communicating those wins. But really, you know, now I'm out of the administration, I can just take a step back. It's like, in the end, it's like people's lives are going to be better, right? I keep coming back to that. It's like, no matter who gets the credit, and to be fair, the Biden-Harris administration deserves the credit, but no matter who gets the credit, it's like, you know, somebody is going to not get sick because of pollution that is coming into their lungs. And people are going to have lower energy bills and they can have some breathing room in their lives. And there'll be new community solar opportunities for people that own homes and rent homes and people who buy used EVs and buy new EVs and people who bike and people who walk. I mean, like all the things that we said, imagine what we could do in the future with clean energy transition. Those are starting to roll out.
Yes.
Now.
Well, that's why I want people to know so that they, you know, so that we can do more. So the other weird thing I often hear from people on the left broadly, the climate left, is like somehow if you celebrate these massive things that happened, you are going to communicate that, oh, we did the job, it's done, we can cross that off and move on to other things. I don't know why people think that, but just based on what you see inside the administration, how clear-eyed are the people in the positions of power about not just the scale of what was done, but the scale of what remains?
Oh, very clear-eyed. One of the first things that I said when I got there is, well, we were in the middle of a COVID response, and really the COVID response was all consuming in that first year.
Yeah.
And what I kind of gingerly tiptoed around, I said, this COVID response thing that we're doing, we're going to have to take a similar effort on climate for the rest of our lives. Right? and that was not met with a dismissal. It was like, yep, I understand. You know, we have things we got to get going on. And I think that that's representative about how many people are working on climate and energy across the administration, because there's lots of stuff to get done. And so I do think that there is a recognition that you have to celebrate wins. Why not? It feels good. Folks have worked hard and it's good to feel like we're getting somewhere, which we definitely are.
Yeah, I do not think bitterness and regret are the sole motivating forces in human life. I think people can, you know, appreciating and being happy about a win can be motivating too. So, you know, you were one of the things I've been impressed by out of the administration is the amount of sort of thought and study. Like we pegged net zero by 2050 as our goal. And it's real easy to do that. You know, it's real easy. Like companies do it all the time. Industries do it. Like it's real easy. It's far away, you know, and you can just sort of say, all right, that's done. But what I've been impressed with is there's been a lot of study and analysis of what that means, like what it concretely means. And you've been involved in some of that, the sort of like, what do we need for 2050? So let's get into that. You know, you have been talking on Twitter and elsewhere about the need to start thinking about an IRA too, or more, I guess, apropos, you know, since there are three uncles, Chip, Bill, and IRA, you know, a new family of bills or a new round of industrial policy to finish the job. So what in your mind, are those, insofar as the community has left some things kind of as magic asterisks, I hate that word, as you say, what are those magic asterisks? Like, what are the things, you know, because a lot of people will say like, oh, electricity is the easy part. Transportation is the easy part. What are the magic asterisks in your mind?
Well, before I get to that part, I want to talk about what we're doing now and where and how far we have to go. And if, I think about these in kind of three buckets. I don't know if you remember, like way back in the day, we were having this, like, do we innovate or do we deploy? You know, that kind of consumed, you know, remember, like, it was like a decade of my life gone.
I remember it unfondly. Yes.
And really the answer is like, and I know this is like unsatisfying, but it's like, we're basically going to have to do both at full speed forever. And what Bill and Ira do is pull clean tech to market with policy and accelerate deployment. They also demonstrate some early deployment technology that are not yet at commercial scale, like hydrogen hubs and DAC, direct air capture. And at the same time, we also now have to be accelerating all of the other stuff that we need to get to net zero that may be at the earlier stage. Now, I, you know, before folks come and get into my mentions, it's like the technology that we have right now is good and it works for most of the stuff that we need to get to net zero. So we have to be deploying that like crazy. And we also have to be building and prototyping and experimenting with stuff that we know that we need in the 2030s and 2040s. And I think what Bill and Ira do is...
Just to, let me just throw it out there that Bill is the infrastructure law, in case anybody is not putting that together.
Yeah, bipartisan infrastructure law and
the
Inflation Reduction Act. What those two bills do is really like lay the groundwork for this decade of deployment. Now, what our job at Office of Science and Technology Policy was, is to really think about that 2035 to 2050 timeframe. And what do we need to do to make things work? You know, a million years ago, I was a civil engineer, and I kind of think about this like a project. And I was trying to come up with a good like analogy. And I think about maybe the Olympics. And it's like, we're going to have the Olympics in Los Angeles. And like, by the time the Olympics open, we need dorms and facilities and stuff.
I don't know if this is the analogy you want.
Yeah, probably not.
I mean, well, this is, to make a substantive point, almost any large scale project that America has tried to do recently, you know, sort of like this is a legendarily slow and expensive and mired in bureaucracy. So I think that's actually, it actually is a dangerously good analogy, which is, can America do this big project better than it does, you know, subways or Olympics or transmission lines? You know, like transmission lines are going to have to be part of it, but like the analogy to a big project just makes me very nervous.
Well, funny that you should mention that, because my first job out of school was working for a New York City subway system on the extension of a subway line that went from Times Square to West Midtown that the New York Times called, let me see, the most expensive subway mile in history, right? So in the end, you think about giant projects that we try to do here in the United States, the Big Dig, the subway extension, the Second Avenue subway, the Olympics. All of these have been fraught with different challenges for much different reasons, and we should be doing those much, much better, much faster, and much cheaper. But in the end, like, you walk around Boston and you're like, this is really nice.
Yeah, they love it.
It worked. And if you think about it from the other side of it, is like, we need to get to that point with decarbonization. And this is how I was trying to frame out this theory of the case, is like, maybe Olympics and mega projects is the right example, because decarbonization might be messy. And it might take longer than we want, and it may be more expensive than we want. We hope not. But we don't really have another choice, right? It's like, we actually have to get to net zero GHG emissions. And the sooner we get there, the less cumulative CO2 emissions we put in the atmosphere. But in the end, it's like we are going to have to manage that transition together as quickly as possible, as equitably, make it equitable and make it as cheap as possible. And so it's like, this is one reason why I've been thinking about this, like a mega project is, we actually have to overproduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions we are shooting for in order to get a net zero by 2050 target. And what I mean by that is like all of these pathways that folks model get us to, you know, like everything works out. It's like, oh, nine things all happen at the same time and we have enough stuff and we have enough labor and it all, like, no surprises and there's no storms. I mean, so it's like,
and we build enough transmission lines.
Right. Well, that's a different challenge. And so it's like, if we were actually doing this, like we need to do this by this early part of the middle of the century, we would take an approach that is like what we call in construction, like building in contingencies. It's like, oh, well, we're going to have to build in a 20% schedule delay, right? So if I think about it from net zero, it's like, what does a 20% schedule delay by 2050 means? It means that we should be shooting for 2045, right? Or 2040, and then maybe we hit 2050.
You have described two, I think, sort of mental and ideological shifts in the carbon world. And I think one of them has taken and one of them hasn't yet. And so let me just quickly say what I mean. The one is, as you say, we used to have this innovation versus deployment argument for just years and years and years. And the answer, which I always thought was pretty obvious, is we do both. And more specifically, we deploy the heck out of what we've got now. And we use this coming decade to deploy what we've got now at huge scale and to research what we're going to need to deploy at huge scale in the 2035 and onward timeframe. Deploying your heart out and researching your heart out at the same time so that when, you know, we reach 2035 and this sort of next round of challenges arise, we'll be ready and we'll have stuff ready. I think that shift has taken. I think people get that now. Maybe I'm being optimistic. Maybe I live in a bubble or whatever, but I feel like at least in the carbon world among energy geeks, we get that. Like we're running as fast as we can and we're preparing for the next leg of the race at the same time. All well and good. The second shift, which you're describing, is one that I'm slightly obsessed with, which is the shift from what, and tell me if you agree, the sort of economistic thinking that dominated the climate space from like the 1990s to, you know, to like 5 years ago, which was all about optimizing, all about precision, all about like, what is the exact carbon price, you know, to the cent that is going to produce the exact right amount of reductions, but not overproduce reductions because we don't want to waste any money. You know, we're optimizing for just the exact right policy. And I think people who are in it, like you, have realized like the world is not like economists' spreadsheets. Lots of things don't work out. Lots of things come up. So you need to overdo it. You need to overbuild, overdesign, do more than you think might be necessary. Build in a buffer, build in some resilience. That shift, I wonder if you think people have gotten that.
You know, I think it's worthwhile academically to be like, what is the optimal policy? So you have some theoretical best outcome, right? But it was a while. I mean, even back in the kind of late 2000s, early 2010s, when we were talking about kind of the carbon tax debate, and not everyone, but folks would be like, well, we put a carbon tax in of $46 per ton, and the next year, like a coal plant with carbon capture and sequestration shows up. And it's like, well, it actually takes like 8 years to do that or seven, you know, whatever. And so like there was always this disconnect between a price signal and physical reality.
Yeah.
In the short run. Now, long run, whatever, like those are the ways that we can guide better, more efficient decisions. But really policymaking is about more than efficiency. It's efficiency, effectiveness, equity, and how well you could administrate something. And we're in a position now that we have to get the entire U.S. and global economy down to zero greenhouse gas emissions in like 25 years. Right? And under those conditions, you try to be as optimal as possible, but you kind of just do what you need to do to make it work under those equity, efficiency, administration, and effectiveness rubric. It's like, there's no more like, well, according to my calculations, we have to do this like exact thing, because that's not how it works when you're building something. You asked a long question a long time ago. It's like, tell me about innovation. And I want to just answer that. So at the Office of Science and Technology Policy, we led this report with our colleagues around the White House and around the government called U.S. Innovation to Meet 2050 Climate Goals, Assessing Our Initial R&D Opportunities. And this really fills in that kind of that back half of like, okay, after the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and after Inflation Reduction Act, what do we need? What do we do? And, you know, the International Energy Agency has said for many years, and now they keep revising this downward a little bit, but it's still about 40% of the technologies that can contribute to net zero targets are in the demonstration or prototype phase.
Yes, although I do think it is significant that it keeps getting revised downward.
100%. And the reason it gets revised downward is we're deploying and making things better, right? So it's like, that's why the innovation versus deployment debate, even back then, was tiring, because we know that innovation comes from deployment. And we know that it's not a linear path, it's a circle. And we can deploy and learn something new. We can do some innovation and it makes our deployment faster. And so what we launched at the White House was the Net Zero Game Changers Initiative that talked about new technologies, improved technologies, enabling technologies. But really, it was the first what we call multi-objective assessment of what are the technologies that we need that could help us get to net zero? How far along are they? And what do we do about it? And so like any, you know, big government PDF, there's 37 technologies in here. It's like, hey, we should do all these things. And, you know, you can't do everything all at once. And we were able to prioritize a bunch. But really, it was to kind of laid out across transportation and electricity and industry and buildings and agriculture and carbon removal. You know, it's like all this stuff that it's like, hey, we should have very low or zero carbon heavy duty vehicles, for example. Like, we actually don't have that solved yet.
Yeah.
And we should have, you know, big investments in understanding the way that we deal with our power grid at the grid edge, the virtual power plants. And so this assessment, you know, we looked at obviously the climate and environment part, but also justice and equity and how that could help with jobs and also how it could help with security and reliability. And we published this report that basically laid out not a roadmap, but a menu of opportunities and ways to think about the future from that 2030s to 2050 timeline of what we actually have to be investing in. You had asked a little bit about what's left. There's plenty of stuff left.
Can I ask a general question about what's left before we get into some of the specifics, which is, you know, I think the sort of conventional wisdom is the stuff we've done so far is, you don't want to say easy to decarbonize, right? Because there's all sorts of very practical social and political barriers, but the stuff we know how to do and have the technology for. And then the sort of conventional wisdom is that what's left, the back half, is the difficult to decarbonize sectors that are hazier and we don't know how to do it. And so what's your sort of like global sense of the back half? Do you think it's going to be more difficult, or do you think it's going to play out like the first half in that when we do the research, we find things, and when we deploy, we learn things, and it turns out to not be as hard as we think? Like, just what's your sort of global sense of the difficulty of the back half?
Well, I think that we made the community in the 2000s and 2010s made a mistake in framing this easy to carbonize, hard to carbonize world, because it was like, oh, we're going to start with electricity and then we're going to do buildings and then transportation and then industry. And so what that did is basically leave industry to now, right? And it also turns out like electricity is not that easy.
Yeah, I mean, like, nothing's it's
like,
easy.
It's like the easy one is still got some challenges. You know, we're making amazing progress, but it's like in a world that needs to get to zero fast, we need to be thinking about not what we can put off till later. Like, later is now, right? And later was then, but now then is now. I'm sorry.
I guess to rephrase this, one way of looking at this would be, we did the low-hanging fruit, and everything else is going to be slower and harder and more expensive and more difficult than that low-hanging fruit.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that, you know, just like there are bad surprises, like, oh, this didn't work out, you know, like cellulosic ethanol, right? That's a bad surprise. Yes. We remember that?
I spent the 2000s, you know, like everybody else, obsessed with it.
And folks were like, hey, we should try this and see if it works. And it largely hasn't achieved the level of technological advancement that we once thought, right? And so that's a kind of a bad surprise. But maybe there's a good surprise. And really, just like, batteries on the grid has really blown my mind. And I don't know if you remember, it was like, yeah, we're probably going to have some batteries in trucks. They're going to provide some frequency regulation, you know, at the margin. And really, before the Biden-Harris administration, there was almost no battery energy storage on the grid. And now it's like 16 Hoover dams worth of batteries on the grid in a few years. And so sometimes it's like, and actually even in the current U.S. long-term strategy that was published in 2021, there wasn't a big emphasis on grid battery storage because it just wasn't competitive. And those types of good surprises is really what gets me excited about things that we think are hard now.
Yeah, that's the point I try to make when I talk about the hot rocks, which I do frequently.
I know,
you know, like,
yeah.
this whole sort of decarbonizing industrial heat, like, well, yeah, it's difficult until a bunch of people went and looked into it, and then they found out, oh, you could just heat up rocks, which is not, you know, like, it's not super difficult or super complicated even. There's just not been a ton of attention to a lot of these things yet, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and this is really where I think is needed next. So you asked a little bit about what should go in the Inflation Reduction Act too.
Yeah, I want to nail you down. I want you to give me like a top three concrete items that you would like to see in an IRA too.
So one of the things that we need immediately is to make sure that electrification works. And that means more efficiency, it means more transmission distribution, and it means more sources of clean generation. And in the very near term, I mean, like this summer, like, what do we need right now? What do we need next year? I think it's what I called virtual power plants for America. There was a DOE liftoff report that liftoff at DOE.gov on virtual power plants. This is basically using all of the things that the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law enable, distributed energy resources, electric vehicles, smart appliances, using those as sources of headroom in a system where we're trying to drive electrification through. So the first item for an IRA 2 is make it easy and make it cheap for utilities everywhere to employ virtual power plants and make it good for customers to do it too.
It's not super obvious to me what federal policy would do that. Like, something I feel fuzzy about on, and this is, I think, applies to some of the other things we need too, which is like, it's not super clear what lever the federal government has to move that. Like, what does that mean? What would the feds do to make it cheaper and easier to do a virtual power plant?
Well, first, you might provide additional incentives both to the customer and to the utilities for integrating these. I mean, the federal government's opportunities, especially in a spending bill, right? And so this is why I'm a little bit hesitant to talk about IRA 2 versus climate policy 2. So an IRA 2 has to be a spending bill or a tax bill.
Yes.
And a broader climate bill can do other stuff, and executive orders can do other stuff. And really, I mean, I would love to see the federal utility, Tennessee Valley Authority and Oak Ridge National Lab and others basically demonstrate, like, here's how a virtual power plant works. Everybody's stuff is cheaper, right? That's one thing that is possible within the federal framework. But it's just like making all of the regulatory lineup with FERC, making all of the opportunities for utilities and customers to take advantage of this there are some federal levers for a VPP for America. A lot of that is going to be run through the states and through public utility commissions. And this is where this, you know, podcast gets super boring, which is like, we need state capacity in public utility commissions.
State capacity, public utility commissions. What, boring? What are you talking about?
So it's like the road to electrification runs through public utility commissions. And we should be investing in those like we invest in any other part of our state and local governments to deliver the types of services that people want.
Indeed, indeed. I have an interesting pod coming on that later this year with some interesting news for people. There's just a little preview.
Oh, exciting. I'm looking forward to it. So the second thing, I mean, I think it's, you know, transmission is already played out. It's like everybody knows we need transmission. I think it's more than that. I think everywhere there's a wire, we need to be investing in it. And so transmission, distribution, and all of our management at the edge of the grid needs a giant grid new deal.
Got a pod coming up on that too. Just not to use this as a preview as a preview reel, but I got a really cool pod coming up on that stuff.
Exciting. Too. I mean, if you think about it, we're trying to drive decarbonization through a largely, you know, nearly all third party or private infrastructure in the distribution system. And we cannot let that, it's not in anybody's interest to let the cost of decarbonization fall to the most vulnerable. And the cost of the distribution system cannot continue to rise as we drive 30, 40, 50, 70% of U.S. energy demand through electrification. So I think that there's climate policy two is a grid new deal. And then climate policy three is, well, 3A and 3B, if you allow me. So 3A is like industrial heat production tax credit or other opportunities just to get the cheapest low-hanging fruit in the industrial sector electrified and decarbonized beyond what's already existing in bipartisan infrastructure law and Inflation Reduction Act. And then 3B is something that I've been kind of hammering on about is like we have about 0.6 gigatons in the agricultural sector. Have you ever, you know, the internet has broken my brain. So, you know, that meme of like somebody starts drawing a horse and it's like really good. And at the end, it's like, it's terrible.
Yes. I know exactly where you're going with this because the internet has broken my brain too.
So it's like the folks who are working in climate smart agriculture are doing a great job and they're working really hard. But really in the end, there's kind of like a shrug. It's like, well, we'll get it reduced some.
Yeah, that's all I ever hear is like a little bit of different kind of crop cover or a different kind of tilling, and which all sounds good to me, but none of it sounds like really getting to zero, right? I mean, you just have zero floating out there.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really where it's like we would really go big on climate smart agriculture and agriculture innovation. And there's lots of opportunities to do that. And I just think that that is... It's something where we're like, oh, yeah, I guess we'll do that later.
Yeah, that's the one that nobody really wants to. I mean, it's just like it's not particularly fun, right? I mean, like energy is kind of fun, but like agriculture just seems like a big, grinding, difficult.
I don't know. I mean, food is good. Like food is fun.
Food is
good. I mean,
that's
you know, true. So like Richard Waite and Alex Rudy at WRI proposed this fertilizer efficiency standard and low carbon fertilizer program. So I think that the ag sector can start to learn from what we've been doing in the energy sector.
Yeah, yeah.
And instead of just like, we're going to make this 9% better, it's like, actually, here's a whole bunch of pathways to get down to zero.
Right.
And so I think that we need a kind of a big clean agriculture and nature-based solutions innovation program as part of IRA 2. So you asked me for 3, I gave you 4, but that's Washington for you.
I'll give you 3A and 3B. I'm a devotee of the outline format. Well, those are interesting. Yeah, I noticed you left off aviation. How do you think about aviation?
You know, aviation is something that gets a lot of attention because it's poised to grow, right? And so there's some estimates, and I was trying to actually get this, sourced, but like I've seen some estimates, it's like 80% of the world hasn't been on a flight.
Yeah.
And it's not that much of U.S. emissions, but it's poised to grow. And again, like we kind of don't have a zero carbon solution right now. We have some opportunities with sustainable aviation fuel. We have some opportunities with electrifying, you know, short haul flights and thinking about hydrogen for longer flights. There's some folks who want to do electrofuels. So I do think, you know, there are incentives in the existing policies that we have that make this better, but those I don't think get us all the way to zero. So really what I, you know, was trying to do in the government is celebrate what we have now, but then ask this question, like, show me the math of gets us to zero in 2050. And if it's not, that's okay. Like, let's go build that math right now. And I think aircraft is definitely one of them. We just don't have a zero carbon solution that is at a price right now that folks would be willing to pay.
Well, I'm sure you, like me, hear 1,000 internet commenters screaming in the background right now, demanding that I ask you, what about flying less? Or more broadly, do you think it is ever the federal government's job to try to change behaviors, to reduce consumption? Like, this comes up with beef too, right? Aviation and beef, I feel like, are the two real examples where most consumption is by wealthy people in wealthy countries. It's going to grow, and it's a problem that could be, like, there are alternatives. Like, you can get people around in other ways, and you can eat other things. You could try to push behavior change. How do you feel about that route?
You know, I think that the policy opportunities here are to make the clean pathway the easiest. And so for flights, for example, I will note, because this is something that I've been hammering on about, like, the bipartisan infrastructure law makes the largest investment in passenger rail since the creation of Amtrak 50 years ago, including a bunch of high-speed rail stuff. And so there's lots of hubs around the United States that could be connected with high-speed rail that would make it much more enjoyable to travel than taking a flight. And so that is the easiest way for mode shifting, is to get those things built and make it easy for folks to do that. And in the same way, it's when we talk about mode shifting out of vehicles, you know, opportunities for everyone to have safe and affordable housing in places where they have employment and leisure opportunities, that's a climate policy. And so I think that we've also, I guess my IRA 2-3C would be, you know, building housing like the climate matters. And doing it efficiently, but also doing it in a way that provides enough so that we're living in an era of abundance than scarcity.
But like many of these remaining challenges, the federal government's control over that is indirect, I would say.
There are some levers, and some of them were blocked by Congress. I mean, so...
Oh, really?
You know, and so there's also ways to add, you know, adders to infrastructure funding around opportunities for housing that is near transit, for example. Now is the time for climate world to be designing, like, what do we want next? Like, what are the good ideas that gets the tons to zero while making life better for everybody?
Right. Well, let me ask you about a few futuristic items that you had occasion to look into more closely in the White House and that are of interest to the future of energy. One is crypto, Bitcoin, whatever the hell they're calling it, the extraordinary rise of power consumption in crypto. How do you led a report on that, an investigation into that. What did that find? Is there a solution to that?
So there was an executive order on ensuring the responsible development of digital assets. And I, with my team, led a report on what is the climate and energy implications of cryptocurrency in the United States. And really what we found, so first of all, I will say for you, David, and for the United States of America, I went and listened to, like, every crypto podcast that I could get my hands on,
and
you know, like Coin Dude 1997's, comments, you know, because I wanted to learn.
Truly, you deserve some hazard pay for that.
Right. Yeah. and, you know, most of it was not helpful, but there was, I will say, the one thing that should be recognized in the crypto sector is that 5% of those folks who are working in there are actually, like, real energy professionals who are turning electricity into money. Like, they know what they're doing. It's easy to dunk on, like, the internet folks who, again, I will say, like, most of it was not helpful. But there are real folks who know how to run businesses and know how to turn electricity into money. And what that report found was that crypto in the United States uses like 1-2% of U.S. electricity. And similarly, it's like 25-50 million metric tons of CO2 per year in the United States. Now, those estimates, there's some uncertainty around them, and maybe they're a little lower, maybe a little higher, but at least it's like an order of magnitude around like what the challenge is. Mm-hmm. Really, in the U.S., which constitutes a lot of the global crypto activity, it's more of a local challenge right now than a climate challenge, in that it's there's the possibility of local crypto asset miners of raising power demand and spiking electricity rates, or there's noise that comes from these miner rigs that happens in communities. And so it's very, what we said is basically, look, we should understand this challenge and make sure that these are not making people's electricity more expensive or causing local emissions or making noise, and also just have an understanding really in the broader digitalization. I think that's where I come back to this, is like turning electricity into money is something that we've been doing for a long time. It just happens that crypto does it very efficiently. But AI also does this very, very efficiently.
Yeah, I was going to ask about AI. I mean, I guess depending on how you think the future is going to go, I think it's probably the case that AI is going to be the bigger power demand in the end, since it seems to require extraordinary amounts of power to do the things it's doing. And every, you know, they just seem to be stampeding into pushing it everywhere. So I guess in the simplest sense, you could just say, well, we just got to decarbonize the grid. So that's decarbonized too. But I just wonder if you ever think that the federal government should have any hand or any role in trying to, I mean, is it ever the right role of the federal government to say, we don't want so much of this, you know, or like, we would like to grow this at a slow, deliberate pace, despite the market's wishes, you know, or is the federal government just there to react to whatever the private market does and try to handle it as best they can?
Well, again, there was another executive order on AI, and I and my colleagues worked on this one and made sure that there was a need to understand how AI affects the grid, how AI affects the climate, how AI affects permitting, and how AI affects transportation. Because I think in the broader sense, you know, in the discussion around AI that we're having now, it's very, very important pieces around, you know, truth and trust and democracy, things that are very important. But what I'm kind of jumping up in the background doing is saying that ethical AI needs a principles for climate safe AI. And I think that there is a policy role for that. There's also a private and nonprofit role for that, is that we need to make sure as AI rolls out AI is just a tool like anything else. And as it rolls out, that it's not cooking the climate and it's also making people's lives better, and that it's enabling the type of energy system that we need for the future. And I'll also note, it's like both for crypto and for data centers, you know, in the last 10 years, there were lots of projections. It's like, look how much electricity that data centers are going to use. Look how much electricity that crypto is going to use. And those have not come to bear because of the way that the innovation and efficiency has happened.
Very familiar story there.
Right. But I actually don't know if this, like, we don't know if AI is going to follow that same, like, oh, it's actually not a problem trajectory.
Right.
And it's worth just like making sure that we don't make a mistake and have to clean it up. Like mm-hmm. The history of the 20th century development in the United States is like, oops, you know, sorry. So how do we make sure that we not do that? And that's where there's a big role for innovation and the government to be working together.
Do you think, here's just, I'll ask you to make a sweeping judgment on AI in passing here in the spot, but like, do you think that AI will contribute more to greenhouse gas reductions through what it enables than it will produce in terms of energy demand?
Yeah. So you're saying,
like, it's going to enable a lot of smart technologies that reduce emissions, right? It's going to enable like better dispatch on the grid, or enable, you know, better mining. Like, it's going to enable a lot of efficiencies and a lot of things that I think will reduce greenhouse gases, you know, just doing things more intelligently and efficiently. AI is going to help with that, but then it's also going to require a bunch of electricity, which will produce a bunch of greenhouse gases. So I'm just like, I'm curious how those two balance out in your head. Do you think it's going to contribute more to decarbonization?
I think it's going to be ultimately net positive for the climate. And here's why. It's like, if we don't have a zero carbon electricity system, the most easiest thing we said was, oh, you know, to decarbonize,
right.
Like the game is over. Right. And, you know, what AI and what other digitization does is requires competition for new, you know, generations. So I'm not dismissing that part. It's like we need massive efficiency and we need to make sure that load growth from digitization doesn't eat the world and doesn't take up resources. I mean, there's only so many like solar projects that you can be running at one time.
Yes.
Right. And so many good sites. I mean, there's actually like it is a finite ultimate like resource in the near term of like how much new renewables we can bring online a year. And if we're doing that to make like amazing cat videos, you know, as much as I love those, then that is a challenge for ultimate decarbonization. But in the end, it's like in 2035 and 2040, if the carbon intensity electricity system is above 100 to 150 grams per kilowatt hour, like we did bad, right?
We're toast regardless.
Yeah, I mean, so it's like, we have to be doing this all at the same time. This is why it's like unsatisfying for the kind of the optimizer. It's like, well, no, we actually have to decarbonize industrial supply chains and manufacturing and transportation and electricity all at the same time.
Yeah. So when you were in the White House, you did some work on transformers, which are a hot topic in climate world right now. There's transformers, you know, for listeners who don't know, they're just, they take high voltage electricity from the grid and lower the voltage and feed it into distribution systems. Some transformers do that. There are other transformers do things, but they're basically electricity infrastructure. And we're very short on them. And every manufacturer is producing at full scale, and they were still very short on them. So I'm curious, A, what you learned about the transformer shortage, because this is all in service of decarbonizing the grid, right? Which is in service of everything else. A, what you found out about transformers, and B, whether you learned anything that you think is applicable in general to the kind of supply chain questions that we're going to face as we're trying to do this.
So transformers basically allow you to use electricity in your house, right? There's electricity on the wires outside. When it comes into your home, the voltage has to go lower so that you can use
step
it on
down.
Your computers. Yeah, steps it down to use it on the stuff in your home. These are fairly old technology. It's not that complicated. But without it, you got nothing, right? Like without these, like there is no electrification. There's no nothing, right? There's no refrigeration, yeah. Right? And so what happened under COVID is a bunch of the factories had some challenges with supply chain. A bunch of the factories had challenge with labor. And then as the kind of demand started picking up and there was supply chain shortages for different types of materials, the demand for transformers started to go, you know, really, really high, and the supply basically didn't increase. And so the market was not reacting to high prices and very long lead times. Ultimately, and we can get into it, and I did a big thread about this over on the internet, but it's basically, it's like there's uncertainty in the supply chain of what type of steel these transformer manufacturers are going to use. There's uncertainty in, well, I don't want to ramp up production now and then have way more capacity than I need later. And then there's also uncertainty around a Department of Energy transformer efficiency rule that's currently under consideration. And so all of these things kind of compounded at once and made this industry basically say like, hey, I'm just going to ride out this period of high prices without adding much more capacity. Now, some is coming online now, but really this gets to the end of like the boring part of decarbonization and the boring part of industrial strategy. It's the materials and the stuff that we're going to need for expanded electrification requires understanding and partnership with the government so that the transition is not messy. Because once the transition starts to get messy, it's over. And it's really, it's like there's a hurricane and folks can't get transformers to redo the lines. The backlash against electrification and the backlash against decarbonization is only like one not related but opportune thing that folks are going to pounce on, you know, away from being, you know, delayed. And so, like, we need Transformers.
So I guess the question is this, are Transformers unique in some way? Is this an odd anomaly, or is this indicative of supply chain problems that we can foresee happening as we decarbonize to 2050?
This happens to be a unique kind of confluence of lots of different factors around labor, supply chain, and regulatory and market that the market alone has not solved, and or at least is not solving in the near term. I think that we should be paying attention, just like we pay attention to critical minerals and critical materials. There are critical parts of the U.S. infrastructure supply chain that will need to have a broader understanding by policymakers to make sure that there's availability in increasing demand. And if you remember, it's like lots of efficiency and LED lighting took off, and a bunch of other structural factors in the U.S. economy has kept U.S. electricity load growth basically flat, right, for a decade. And so now it's like people are starting to use electricity again. The utilities are like, wait, you know, it's almost weird. It's like, this isn't this how you all make money? Like, why aren't you ready for this? Why aren't you putting this into your integrated resource plans? It's
don't
like
get me started.
The IRA has teed up all of this electrification for utilities to say, wait, this is, we can actually make more money by doing electrification. To me, again, this is a challenge. It's like, this is the proverbial, like, dollars are on the ground, why aren't they picking it up? And so we have to understand non-market factors, and so, you know, socio-technical systems and all the stuff that academics talk about. It's like, actually, it doesn't always work when, like, the price signal shows up and then the market responds. In some cases, there's friction and there's asymmetric incentives and there's information gaps. I mean, all the things that we know happen, right? And to me, we need a utility sector that is like, we understand that the government wants to electrify lots of stuff because it's good for climate. We are going to respond, and it's going to be good for our workforce, and it's going to be good for our communities. It's going to be good for the climate. I believe that that world is possible.
A world of good utilities. You really are a utopian. We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask about one other future thing, which is of great interest to a lot of people that you also did some work on, which is fusion. How are they thinking about fusion up there in the White House? Because I know out here in the wild, there are folks who will say, we're going to get to fusion, and when we get to fusion, that will solve all the problems, and everything else is noise. You did some fusion work. Was that your conclusion?
So first, I will say, fusion is awesome. It's creating a star on the Earth. And
just wild. As,
like, in like science land, it's wild, right? It's like, we are going to harvest this, like, make the energy of a star and put it in a machine and, like,
and boil water with it. Cool.
that's one pathway. But you know what? I like hot water, right?
Yeah,
I like hot water.
It's handy.
I like
steam is handy.
I like steam. I like cold drinks. Like, fusion is a cool technology that maybe doesn't play in this near term round of, like, we actually have to get deployment ramped up for 2050. But, like, the world continues after 2050.
Indeed.
And we should be doing cool stuff and doing cool science because it's important for humanity. And so my boss at the time, Sally Benson, and I and our colleague Rachel Rioffi in White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, we led the first White House summit on fusion energy. We developed, you know, with the rest of the White House, the president's bold decadal vision on fusion energy. There's like $6 billion in private investment around fusion because folks want to, you know, they see this opportunity to do something with near limitless fuel. Now there's different pathways and, you know, much different and much smaller amounts of radioactive waste than traditional fission power, nuclear power. And really it's an opportunity to do cool science that ultimately, hopefully, works out for humanity and for the climate. It's indicative kind of all of, like, the innovation versus deployment debate. It's like, there's no way, no how, that we are going to wait till 2050 or whenever. Maybe it's 2032. Like, I'm hoping it's the end of the decade that fusion shows up.
Really? You think that's a live possibility?
That would be at the outside edge of possibility. I mean, I think that there is a decent chance that it works in our lifetime. I think that there's a somewhat chance that it works in the next 10 to 20 years. But you know what? Like, even if it doesn't get there by doing R&D about it, this is what, you know, government R&D is supposed to do. It's like, we learn about new science and maybe new pathways in other materials shows up in superconducting magnets or other, you know, computing technologies. Like, we can do science for science sake and good things can happen and we don't really know what will happen yet. I do think that there is a pathway for fusion. The government is doing amazing work on it. There's milestone programs that are kind of ramping up. And for the first time, it feels like there's a there. I was at COP28 and we launched an international fusion partnership. And so it's like, we can imagine a better world, right? It's like, this is where I want to come back to. It's like, we can celebrate all the awesome stuff that's in the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and Inflation Reduction Act. We can do awesome science and do new innovations while also being very clear-eyed. It's like, we actually have a giant climate problem. We have to get zero. And we can do those things at the same time. And I am super excited about fusion and all these other magic asterisks, as we call them, because some of them are going to work and some of them won't, but none of them are going to work if we just sit on the sidelines and do nothing.
Do you have another dark horse technology that you think people aren't paying enough attention to now and might turn out to be a big deal?
This is a way more boring technology, but it's like reconductoring our transmission lines, just like hanging a different metal on transmission lines and getting, you know, double or almost double as much electricity through that, like without doing anything. And so the, you know, the cost of that has to go down. The different types of technologies have to be advanced, but it's like, there's low hanging fruit that we think about and efficiencies that we should be doing all the time. And then there's just like new technologies that we have to advance and see how good they are and see if they can work.
So I guess I would conclude by asking, I love your optimism. I love your positive attitude. And you say we can do these things. We can innovate while we're deploying. We can research. But the process you describe, and I think you'd agree, to really work has to be intensely iterative, i.e. we have to do a bunch of stuff, be open and sensitive to what is and isn't working, and then adjust our strategy accordingly. This, I think, is the flip side of the overabundance or overbuilding notion. Like, if you're going to do that, you have to be equally committed to sort of trimming the branches that don't work. And I just, like, I look at the U.S. federal government and, like, nimble, responsive, able to shut down programs when they don't work. These are not descriptors that leap to mind. I guess, you know, based on seeing inside the beast, should I be more optimistic about our ability to do good policy than I am?
Yes. You know, what I saw every day in the White House and in the agencies was career professionals who get up every day and work hard and do their best to make people's lives better. I know that that sounds cliche.
All of whom could be making much more money somewhere else.
Yeah, and there's folks who, absolutely, they are really committed to making sure that their corner of the government is working well and working efficiently, and they're really giving it their all. It was frankly inspiring every day to be seeing that. You know, there was the political appointees, of course, like that's their job to come in and implement the president's policies. But there's a much bigger and much larger career government scientist, engineer, policy, budget, finance, admin.
The deep state is what we call that, Costa.
You know, but it was
the deep state.
It was the deep state in that, like, they cared.
Yes, the deep state is good, actually. This is the recurring theme.
I know that this is like veering into like cliche kind of cheese territory, but it's like, I don't think that folks realize how hard the people in government are working to make people's lives better. So you asked if the government could be nimble. You know, you remember that there was a giant algae research program that was happening in the Department of Energy that the government just shut down, right? And so that we have seen opportunities over time for good and bad where research programs have been sunset. But one of the things that I was trying to make sure we start thinking about is this kind of integrated engineering and deployment around the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and Inflation Reduction Act investments. It's that, like, we should have folks out at the hydrogen hubs and the direct air capture hubs and all the other investments that have been made, like collecting data, doing new innovations, like the way that we get circular innovation embedded in the bloodstream of the U.S. Ecosystem is like, while we're deploying, we're coming up with new opportunities to fix stuff. It's like, oh, I wish I had a valve that did this. And it's like, you could send that back to ARPA-E or to DARPA or somebody else. Right. Like, oh yeah, go make that valve. Like, and so like, I think that we've done a lot of good in enabling nimble ecosystems to flourish in the government. We're not all the way there yet. And I think in an IRA 2 situation, I would be doing more of, let's learn as much as we can while we're deploying. And so it's not just learning by doing. It's like, oh, I built this one thing. I'm going to build it the next time and it'll be cheaper, faster, better. That is good. But it's also, it's like, I'm building this thing and I'm running to a problem. I wish we could be innovating on the fly and designing like a Skunk Works program. It's like, oh, fix this. And like, I think that there's opportunity to do rapid prototyping using the ARPA model to enable even better learning by doing as we move forward. That's a little bit of like innovation geek speak, but it's like we're putting all this money into deployment. We should benefit from it as well as from the innovation side.
Absolutely. And I will say, just to reinforce, from the outside, things look real bad. And I think it's easy to see the dysfunction. It's easy to see things go wrong. It's easy to see stupid people saying stupid stuff. But I will say, almost without exception, everybody I talk to who goes into the federal or state bureaucracy to try to work on things like this comes away sounding starry-eyed like you. Just really impressed, just really impressed with the bunch of people who care working really hard. I wish that message could get out more. Like, there's a lot of good people in there working really hard to do good things.
There's a lot of cynicism, right? And there's a lot of reason to be cynical. I mean, there's lots of challenges that we have in the country right now. But I remain optimistic around the spirit of possibilities that is really like enabled in the U.S. and now global like clean energy ecosystem. It's like people want to do something that matters in their lives. And decarbonization is the theme that is going to be with us for the rest of our careers. And folks are excited to help and build and grow that type of better future for everybody.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on. And thanks for all your work in the administration. And now you're back teaching, directing things, academizing for the time being.
Yeah, I'm super excited. I lead Carnegie Mellon's university-wide energy institute, the Scott Institute for Energy Innovation.
Oh, fun.
And we have a great team driving the innovation that we need to get to net zero from the outside.
You're a warrior on the side of good and right. So thanks again. Thanks for coming on.
I really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Volts podcast. It is ad-free, powered entirely by listeners like you. If you value conversations like this, please consider becoming a paid Volts subscriber at volts.wtf. Yes, that's volts.wtf, so that I can continue doing this work. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.